Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Twanda Black, your host, and joining me this morning, Wally Vaughn. He served as a chaplain in the United States Air Force for nearly 30 years. He's a person in the civil rights leadership during that time, and he's written a book called The Invisible Leader in Montgomery, 1955 to 1956. And a very interesting book. How are you doing, Wally?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am wonderful. I'm wonderful.
Bless you.
You know, we're really here to talk about where are the civil rights leaders like those of the past. And also, you know, in conjunction with that, talking about your book, because you talk about the invisible leader in Montgomery doing the bus boycott. So First of all, let's talk about leaders of today. I think we hear a lot of people say we don't have any leaders, that there is no clear leader in civil rights or in the Black movement or whatever you want to call it, but there's no clear leaders. What do you say about that?
I would start by saying people recognize names at the national level from the past. Mm-hmm. But what people must understand is how and from whence those leaders of the past emerged. And I think that is where it might be a slight disconnect or maybe a major disconnect. Because if we take Montgomery to illustrate the point, what happened in Montgomery with the bus affair was a local event undertaken by local residents to address a local problem in the local area to make life better in their city and local community. So rather than talking about leaders at the national level and no defined person, the question probably is, where are the local leaders today? Because what happened in Montgomery, it was people at the local level who emerged to become recognizable at the national level. Mm-hmm. Montgomery was a local event that gained national attention.
So did it gain national attention because of Dr. Martin Luther King? Or did he get big because of that situation?
He got big because of that situation. And that takes us into the invisible leader piece in Montgomery, which this work took about 20 years or so. But there was a lady in Montgomery named Joanne Gibson Robinson. Mm-hmm. For your listeners, she was a native of Georgia, a graduate of Fort Valley State College. She was the person who strategized, conceived, and came up with a plan for the people to come off of the buses on Monday, December the 5th, 1955. Mm-hmm. She actually drafted up the message inviting the people to come off the buses. The messages were pre-mimeographed. That is, they were mimeographed prior to the arrest of Mrs. Park. Mm-hmm. Joanne Robinson had everything set in motion, and she was the invisible leader. And this is how we know she was the invisible leader. When Mrs. Park was arrested on Thursday evening, the people did come off the buses on that Monday. Mm-hmm. Well, Mayor Gale and the city council, they didn't hinder things. They said, okay, there's excitement about the lady being arrested Thursday night. Leave this alone. Well, the people stayed off the buses all week. Then the next week. But initially, the mayor and the city council said, well, this is all spontaneous. It will end. Well, anything that's done spontaneously, it should begin to weaken, you know, within a short period of time. Well, by the third or the fourth week, instead of the bus protest weakening, it was gaining momentum. Mm-hmm. And by the last week in December, the mayor and the city commission said, we missed something. What we're looking at is not the result of spontaneous reaction. Mm-hmm. This is undergirded by some organized planning. Now, they said, but the one who's doing the talking, who was Reverend King, they said, he's not leading this. Mm-hmm. And here's why. They said he's new in town. He's only been here 15 months. And out of the 15 months, he was gone most of that time at school in Boston, coming back on the weekends to preach. So probably his full number of days in Montgomery might have come to maybe 8 or 10 months. Mm-hmm. And they were asking, how can a man who's been in town that briefly, who has a very small congregation downtown, which averages about 100 people each Sunday, that's his largest base of constituency, how did he rally 50,000 people overnight? Then the second question the man, the city commission, asked themselves was, this man has no leadership skills, that is, in terms of leading the masses. Mm-hmm. That was not intended to be an insult. It was the reality. Mm-hmm. From age 5 or 6 until 27, when the protests began, he was in school all of his life. Mm-hmm. He only knew the halls of academics. So they said, he's never led anything. So how did he do all of this? And then that's when they said, you know, someone else is running this. And they began to search for the, what I call the voice behind the voice. Mm-hmm. He was doing all the talking, mm-hmm. but they said, no, he's voicing or articulating the views of someone else. Now, this is how, and I'm going to let you talk in a moment and ask questions, but we have to lay the groundwork.
Of course.
This is what really brought things to a head. In January of 1956, there was a reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser named Tom Johnson. He was the person who was assigned to go to the negotiations between the Montgomery Improvement Association representatives and Mayor Gale and the City Commission. Tom Johnson said in an article, he said, the strangest thing about these meetings is that the newest man in town is doing all the talking. He said, there are preachers here that I know who've been in Montgomery 10, 20 years. They don't say anything. And he said, there's something wrong with this picture. So Tom Johnson was the first one to go on record and put in print that he was suspicious about this whole thing and had reservations about who the leader was. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in time, Mayor Gale and everybody else said the same thing. And there were people who came to Montgomery, primarily the Fisk University sociology team came in January of 56. The lead professor was named Professor Donald Ferron, F-E-R-R-O-N. He wrote in his journal on January the 19th, after being in town about 2 weeks, he wrote, the public recognizes Reverend King as the leader, but I sense there is another leader, though unknown to the public, perhaps Joanne Robinson. Now, it was something about her that the way in which she conducted herself and conducted affairs, it resonated in a way with visitors to say, you know, she seems to be the one who's running the show. You know, that's how it is. You can go into a place and they may say, well, somebody's in charge. You say, but yeah, but it seems to me like so-and-so are really running it. And that's what was happening in Montgomery.
So what
and
happened?
So the mayor,
oh, I'm so sorry. I was going to ask what happened when they figured out that it was Joanne Robinson.
That's the beauty in that story, ma'am. They never figured it
they
out.
They never figured it
she
out.
She went all 13 months, and they never fingered her. She was even arrested on February the 21st when, as newspapers from that era said, there was a mass arrest of all the Negro leaders in Montgomery, mm-hmm. as the oppressor would say, who was pulling the thing. And Joanne Robinson was arrested among them, but bail was posted and she left. And there's a piece in the book on the whole thing. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. yes, they had the invisible leader in their clutches, but because they were unsure who it was, she posted bail and walked out of jail. They kept on leading the thing.
Well, what do you think that if they had found out that she was the leader, the mastermind behind this whole boycott, what would they have done to her?
Yeah, let me compliment you on saying the mastermind, because that's how she's referred to in the work. She mm-hmm. was the mastermind. Well, we know what would have happened, and you have a very powerful question. Thank you. That is why Ralph Abernathy, Reverend King, and all of the others kept her invisible. They knew what would have happened to her. She mm-hmm. would have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. But because she had the strategy, because it was her plan, her vision. Had she been destroyed, everything would have fallen through.
Right, right.
Because you remove the one with the vision, and you know what happened.
You cut off the head. Mm-hmm.
You cut off the head, that's right, everything dies.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
That's how we come to the point of, yes, Reverend King was not the leader in that setting. He did rise to receive all the accolades,
mm-hmm.
but Joanne Robinson, who had to remain invisible, yes, there was nothing said about her during that era.
Wow.
But she was the ringleader. And it, one of the things that tickled me, and you may not find it amusing, but when they had the negotiations with the mayor down in his chambers and the city commission, they were looking for the invisible leader, and guess what? She was sitting right across the table from him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was looking right in her face.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But he had no idea about whom he was looking at.
She,
Joanne Robinson was just, she was, people always say, Wally, you're so passionate about her. I'm more passionate about the truth, but I must admit, I have great admiration for Joanne Robinson,
mm-hmm.
or the late Joanne Robinson.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think what was interesting about that is that she had to be a very humble servant to keep her mouth.
Yeah.
You know, because most people would have been saying, hey, that's you taking credit for what I did, you know, and she had to be humble.
May I say something? You preaching now, but that's true.
She had to be so humble to do that.
Especially during that period
mm-hmm.
when, you know, the name of Reverend King and Abernathy and others were
mm-hmm.
appearing in all of the newspapers,
mm-hmm.
all of the national magazines. That is correct. And she remained silent, held her post, kept pursuing her vision that we're going to stay the course and make this happen. And
wow.
She never said a word. That
yeah,
is correct.
That is something right there. How long did she live? When did she pass on?
Now she did a book that was published in 1987,
mm-hmm.
if my memory serves me correct, and I think she passed shortly before her work was published.
Wow.
Now, she doesn't tell all of this in her work.
Mm-hmm.
May I share something unique about her book, if you have time?
Yes.
The book is entitled The Montgomery Bus Boycott and the Women Behind It. It's supposed to be her memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Scholars say, if you really want to know what happened in Montgomery, read the book by Joanne Robinson. Well, she did something else with that book. In the front of the book, she has a poem. When people write a book, they might put a verse of a poem or a line or a song
mm-hmm.
or something in their favorite scene. In the front of her book, she has the poem by Paul Lawrence Dunbar entitled The Mask.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask myself, why would somebody put a poem entitled The Mask in the front of a history book?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense to you?
Well, in her
no.
case, it does.
Now, what she was saying was, whoever reads this poem, you've already picked up on what I'm doing. I have masked information in this book.
Mm.
I've laid clues in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read carefully, I will unfold the clues to you. That's basically how I became acquainted with, okay, she was the leader, the mastermind, the invisible personality.
Mm-hmm.
And she does have some clues masked in her book, but scholars have never picked up on it because she masked the clues in such a shrewd manner, mm-hmm. people just read right over the clues.
Wow. Wow, that's phenomenal.
Now, let me give you a clue that she left, which none of your listeners, I would say over 55 years of age, can argue with. She said after the arrest of Mrs. Parks that she and two students got together. She typed enough stencils for them to mimeograph over 10,000 sheets, cut them in thirds because they had the message inviting people to come off the buses, typed in three pieces to each stencil.
Mm-hmm.
So she started at midnight and said by 4 a.m. Friday morning, she typed between 30 and 40 stencils. The two students had mimeographed over 10,000 sheets, cut them in thirds, bound them in stacks of 50 or 100. You could not have done all of that work in 4 hours.
Wow.
So if the mimeograph sheets were not mimeographed after the arrest of Mrs. Parks, the only other time the work could have been done was before she was arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the clue she gave. She laid the clue in that she said, anybody who knows anything about the mimeograph machine will know nobody did that volume of work in 4 hours.
Not with that particular one, with the hand crank, and you got to do,
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
The old hand crank mimeograph machine that you may have been able, might have been able to do 50 copies an hour. Maybe. So that's how she laid out what they did, and scholars bought into it. They said, yeah, after the arrest, she got two people together, and they did all this work. No way.
Yeah.
Impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. Does she have relatives? So, did you get a chance to talk to her, some of her relatives?
No, never got a chance to talk to any of the relatives. I think she was from a little town called something like Cullen, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm unsure of the spelling, whether it's C-U-L-L-E-N or C-O-L-L-E-N. But she should still have relatives in there, and I think she had a daughter, but I've never read anything about the daughter to try and find out how I might contact her and engage her regarding her mother and the work of her mother.
So, you know, all that being said, you talk about how leaders were strategizers at that time. Is there any parallel between what we see today in protest and what we saw back then? A lot of us say they're just out marching with no rhyme or reason. There's not an end game to this. So what do you see? Are there any parallels?
Well, I'm unsure about parallels. I always answer an interviewer this way. Some of the older philosophers like Herd and Schleiermacher and others have cautioned us against drawing comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
I think what people need to do, first of all, I think we really need to do more work from the era of the movement, because something like Joanne Robinson and what happened in Montgomery, if we are just now discovering that, then the question has to be asked, how much more have we been promoting over the last 60 years, which is also erroneous. So maybe before even talking along those lines about strategizing and so forth, maybe we need to go back and see how people really strategize, how things really worked in these local communities. I'm willing to go on record saying if someone were willing to do research, and it'd probably make a good thesis for somebody doing a PhD, go across the South, the South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, go into the small communities and counties, and ask people, who was the leader in this county back in the 40s and 50s? And I'm willing to say almost every county had someone. It might have been the preacher. It might have been what they called then one of the Negro teachers or the principal, the guy who owned the funeral home. In some places, it was the fellow who was the barber in town. But every county had a go-to person, if you will.
And I know that's true.
Right now, you go to a county, you said you don't hear any names.
Yeah.
Like, I came from South Carolina, where I'm from. Well, there was a gentleman in the African Methodist Episcopal Church there in Sumter, Mount Pisgah, AME. I'm Baptist by background. I grew up in Trinity Baptist Church, where Reverend H.J. Chauvin was the pastor. But Reverend Fred James, who was the pastor at Mount Pisgah AME, was the leader in Sumter County. Now, it's a name nobody recognizes outside of Sumter County, but that illustrates the point. They may not have been known outside of their county, but the people in the county knew them. It was all local.
So, Wally, tell people where they can get The Invisible Leader in Montgomery, 1955 to 1956.
They can go online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They can Google my name, Wally G. Vaughn, and all the works will appear. Did a similar thing in Selma with oral accounts. If you really want to know what happened in Selma, you should read what the people who were born and reared in Dallas County, as they tell their story about what happened during that period. You will see something fully different than what you get in history books.
And you're also working on another piece right now, right?
Yes, I have some manuscripts just kind of lying in wait. People don't publish the kind of works that I write. Let me tell you, readers, something they may have never heard. Have you ever heard of Prince Edward County, Virginia?
Yes.
Okay. You aware of what happened there?
I don't remember, but I know I've heard
That's
of it.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. I'll refresh your memory and for readers, introduce them for those who aren't aware. The public schools in Prince Edward County, Virginia, were closed from September 1959 to September 1964.
Mm-hmm.
The boys and girls of African descent, our people, did not go to school in that county for 5 years.
My goodness.
Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the schools were closed, the white children did not miss one day, because when they shut the schools down, the private public school system was ready to open up.
Mm-hmm.
So they kept on going to school. So I worked at that county for over a decade and have over 150 stories from those who were locked out of the schools. Wow. Now they're in their late 60s, they're in their 70s.
Mm-hmm.
But they tell, as any story might be, there's laughter in their story, there's pain in their story, sorrow, you name it. But it's a wonderful collection of stories. So when that is available, it's available. When we can get it published, we're going to put that out to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would like to encourage your listeners, we have got to get out among the people and let them tell their own story.
Mm-hmm.
You see, if you tell your own story, you're going to tell it different than when someone else tells your story for you.
Right, right.
And that is what has been happening, and that's probably why we have Montgomery all twisted up, because other people have tried to tell that story
mm-hmm.
for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so those who lived through the trying period of our history, who are probably now 70 and 80 years old,
yes,
we have about 20 years left to get the remaining accounts from them. After 20 years from now, it'll be no one left who can talk intelligently about having grown up during that period.
And tell their own story.
And tell their own story.
Mm-hmm.
Ma'am, you got it right.
Yes, yes.
And we missed that in a few other critical areas. Now, I've done no work with it. I tried. Let's take the Tuskegee Airmen. A powerful story. But tell me where I can get a book.
Mm.
Where they told their accounts in their own tongue,
mm-hmm.
Out of their own mouth of what happened. There is no such book.
Wow.
So we missed that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it may be out of 900 and something, I think maybe 50 are yet alive. Somebody need to go to them and let each one know, tell the story.
Yes.
Don't tell me what's already
if they can remember it at this point.
Other people
yeah.
added to you.
Mm-hmm.
No, tell me out of your own mouth.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
All right, now, so the book, the latest book, The Invisible Leader in Montgomery, 1955 to 1956, you can find it online, Amazon, wherever they sell online
yes.
books. And
yes.
Wally's last name is V-A-U-G-H-N, Vaughn, Wally
that
Vaughn.
That is correct.
Thank you
yes,
so much
ma'am.
For joining us, sir, and just sharing your insight from the civil rights movement. Thank you so much.
I thank you so very much, and God bless you and your audience.